This is continuous coverage.
Continuous coverage.
Continuous coverage. In the trial of Lori Vallow Daybill from the Hidden Killers podcast.
Hidden Killers podcast.
We're up to segment number two in our continuous coverage in the trial of Lori Vallow Daybill. Let's head to the courtroom.
Okay, we're on the record on case CR 22-21-1624, State of Idaho versus Lori Noreen Vallow. The prosecution's here present, as well as the defense and the defendant. The court would note that the jurors are now in the courtroom, all properly seated and accounted for. I believe they've all signed their daily juror affirmation. Is that correct, Mr. Bailiff?
Yes, sir.
Very well. Thank you again for your continued service and adhering to the court's instructions. In terms of our scheduling, the court will intend to stop at noon today, or roughly around noon if we can. We'll do a mid-morning short break. And I'll note that the state has called its next witness. The witness has been sworn already. We had some testimony as it related to the exclusionary rule argument, and that's been resolved. So the court doesn't have any further inquiry for the witness before you start with your examination. Ms. Smith, if you'd like to commence with direct, you may.
Thank you, Your Honor. Good morning, sir.
Good morning.
Sir, can you introduce yourself to the ladies and gentlemen of the jury and spell your last name?
Yes. My name is Douglas Hart, H-A-R-T.
Sir, how are you employed?
I am currently employed as the chief deputy for the Canyon County Sheriff's Office. The sheriff is the elected official. The chief deputy is second in command underneath the sheriff.
How long have you been at the Canyon County Sheriff's Department?
Approximately 8 months.
Okay. How long? Where were you before that?
From September of 1995 through September of 2022, I was employed as a special agent for the Federal Bureau of Investigation.
Can you give us a little bit of information on your background as a special agent with the FBI?
Certainly. I attended the FBI Academy in Quantico, Virginia, and graduated from the academy. My first assignment was to the Honolulu, Hawaii division. I was assigned to the Organized Crime and Drug Squad. So during my time in Hawaii, I specialized in long-term, complex, multi-subject investigations. We did a lot of conspiracy cases. I got my first experience in homicide investigations in Hawaii. We had two homicides that my squad investigated that took place on military installations in Hawaii. After 5.5 years in Hawaii, I sought out a relatively unique assignment in the FBI.
Which was?
Wherever there is an Indian reservation, you will find a small satellite FBI office. At any given time, 2-3% of the FBI are designated as Indian country agents. That assignment is unique in that most persons' crimes don't fall under federal jurisdiction. However, for Indian reservations, the FBI along
Judge, I'm going to object to that. This is irrelevant information that he's giving, just to bolster his own credibility.
Well, Your Honor, his experience and access to direct investigations into persons' crime is relevant, and it goes to lay a foundation for the findings and observations he made as one of the primary investigators in this matter.
All right. Well, I understand laying the foundation. I think at some point the detail might become additional than we need for just foundation for this particular case, but I'll overrule the objection at this point, Ms. Smith.
Thank you, Your Honor.
So you were discussing about your investigative background in various Indian reservations.
Yes.
What other experience did you have as a line investigator in those territories?
So I spent 7 years on the Nez Perce Indian Reservation working mainly violent crimes and persons crimes. I investigated a number of homicides and related crimes.
Where did you transfer? You said you spent 7 years. Well, you're with the FBI longer than that. So where did you transfer to after you went to the Nez Perce Indian Reservation?
In 2001, I transferred to the Boise, Idaho Resident Agency, where I was assigned as the supervisor for the Treasure Valley Metro Violent Crime Task Force.
What were your responsibilities as the supervisor for that violent crime task force?
So that task force was led and funded by the FBI. Our primary responsibility was to investigate gang violence and organized crime violence, drug trafficking. So I was the supervisor of the task force, but also an investigator on a day-to-day basis.
Where did you proceed after you were part of the or head of the violent crime task force?
So I spent 7 years in that capacity. In June of 2015, I was promoted to be the supervisory senior resident agent.
What does supervisory senior agent mean?
That means I was the supervisor for all FBI criminal programs in the 34 southern counties of Idaho, which included agents in our Boise office and agents in our Pocatello office.
So as the supervisor, did you continue to be involved in direct investigative activity yourself?
Absolutely.
Why?
What's that?
Why?
The FBI is fairly minimally resourced in Idaho. I had responsibilities as a supervisor for the agents that worked for me and for their cases, but I also continued to work as a case agent on a number of matters that I was able to essentially assign to myself.
Let's back up just a little bit. What training did you have in terms of investigation and investigative supervisory responsibilities?
So the initial training for an FBI agent takes place at the FBI Academy in Quantico, Virginia. It's approximately 17 weeks of training over a variety of subject matters. And then subsequent to that, I've attended many what we call in-service trainings that are specific to a specialized law enforcement duty or topic, such as crime scene management schools, interviewing, interrogation schools, written statement analysis schools, so on and so forth.
Did you have any training with the identification and location of clandestine graves?
Yes.
Can you tell us a bit about that training?
So when you are assigned as an Indian Country agent, you attend a special crime scene management school that's a very intensive week-long course that encompasses a lot of different aspects of crime scene management and investigation. The FBI has evidence response teams, but they were 11 hours away from where I was situated, so we did all of the crime scene work ourselves. Part of that training was the identification and location of clandestine grave sites.
What does clandestine grave mean?
It means someone has buried a body where they don't want it to be found, and so that's the clandestine part of it.
And so you receive training in the clandestine grave location and identification?
Location, identification, as well as grave exhumation.
Okay. What does that mean?
That means the process of exhuming a body that's been buried. There are techniques and measurements that are required as you undertake that endeavor in a crime scene. It has to be done very carefully and according to strict procedures.
And you talked a bit about your training, and now let's talk about approximately how many cases have you been a criminal investigator on in your overall capacity with the FBI?
Hundreds. It would be hard to put a specific number on it.
Approximately how many homicides have you been part of the investigation of?
I would say conservatively between 20 and 30 homicides.
Okay. And how many cases have you been involved in which involve crimes against children?
There are lots of types of crimes against children. I would say over 50.
Any of those cases involve investigations into missing or suspected abducted children?
Yes, several.
Okay. What was your role Well, let's do it this way. What was the FBI's role in those cases in investigating missing or potentially abducted children?
Well, the FBI has nationwide jurisdiction. So if a child has been abducted and taken across state lines, then those cases fall under the FBI's purview. But more than that, for many, many years, the FBI has taken the stance that when a child goes missing, our capabilities, coupled with those of city, county, or state investigators, need to be brought to bear immediately so that we can seek the best outcome in locating and safely recovering those children. So whether or not those cases fall under the federal system, the FBI still responds to cases of missing children and participates fully in those investigations.
Whether or not they're the lead, they always support the local law enforcement on trying to find the children.
Correct.
How many of those cases have you been involved with personally?
A true child abduction or missing child case is fairly rare, but I have been involved in between 6 to 10 of those cases during my career.
And in that time, you mentioned earlier about responded rapidly. Why is that?
Well, we know from studying these cases that if a child is going to be killed, they're typically killed within 24 hours of being abducted. And so you have a very small window in which to respond and utilize all of the tools and resources that we have working cooperatively with our partners to try to locate and recover that child.
As a procedural matter and to aid in getting ready for some exhibits, the state requests permission to display State's Exhibit 29C and 29D. The entirety of 29 is are the iCloud records for Lori Vallow, as documented through LolliTime at iCloud.com and Lori for Style at iCloud.com. C and D are the entirety of both records, and given that in a few minutes we'll be displaying some of those, I need to move for those admissions right now so that Mr. Wood can get resources up.
All right. Can you clarify for me? Previously, we've admitted 29. Is that correct?
Yes, Judge. Those records were admitted with the stipulation on the business record certification with the defense. And A was as to, let me pull up my exhibit list so I don't misstate. Was the certified business records for Lori for Style at iCloud.com. 29B was the certified records for LolliTime at iCloud.com. C is the entirety of Lori for Style at iCloud.com. And D was the entirety of LolliTime at iCloud.com.
And C and D have been previously admitted?
Well, the entirety of 29 has been admitted because it's the records that would go with the certified attachment. We just hadn't published those or offered them in the courtroom yet. As we've done on all our sort of voluminous records, we admit the business record certification, and then we display specific pages. But given some rulings of the court where we have the entirety of the actual documents that are part of 29 in the two exhibits C and D.
Okay, well, they are separate exhibits, so still I don't believe they've been offered and admitted. So for purposes of the record, before we begin any kind of publishing from them or reference, I think we need to go through that procedure.
Okay, Your Honor. May I ask the witness be shown State's Exhibit 29C and 29D, please?
Yes.
Thank you, sir.
a copy of this been provided to the defense?
Yes, an exhibit in August of 2021. That's the documents you were given in discovery. It's the iCloud accounts provided in August of 21.
All right, go ahead, Ms. Speaker.
Thank you. Agent, looking at, do you recognize states 29C and D?
I do.
How do you recognize two thumb drives?
On these two thumb drives are the copies of the Lori 4 style at iCloud.com iCloud contents and the Lollytime at iCloud.com contents. My initials are on each of these thumb drives.
Okay. And you helped prepare those to make sure that they, you could make sure those records as part of the business records were the ones you observed, you looked at.
That's correct.
Okay. And you observed those. And the only thing on those two thumb drives are the entirety of Lori for Style at iCloud.com and the entirety of Lollytime at iCloud.com.
Yes.
Okay. C is Lori for Style at iCloud.com.
Yes.
And D is Lollytime at iCloud.com.
That's correct.
Okay. How do you know that?
Because I'm the one who made the copies of the thumb drives.
From the business records?
Correct.
Okay. And the thumb drives are marked?
Yes.
Okay. Move for the admission of States Exhibit 29C and 29D.
Any objection?
Yes, Your Honor. We would object to any hearsay contained therein, and we believe that there is multiple layers of impermissible hearsay, so we'd ask the court not to admit those.
All right. What's the response from the state?
Your Honor, the, any statements of the defendant in her own words are being reflected in that document. Any statements of co-conspirators are admissible and not considered impermissible hearsay. So communications between her, Alex Cox, other co-conspirators, including Chad Daybell, are relevant and admissible and allowed before the jury. Anyone who is not a co-conspirator, their statements aren't being offered for the truth of the matter asserted. They're simply being offered to provide context as to what the defendant's response was. It goes directly to motive, intent, that there's absence of any mistake on this issue, and therefore are highly probative and relevant.
All right. And could you, I know I've already asked this, but could you again explain to me how these tie into 29? Not a sub, but just the Exhibit 29.
Exhibit 29 was the certified business record. And at the beginning of the case, the defense agreed with the state that we, if we admitted the certification of the business records, that the state could produce various portions of those records rather than the record in entirety. We recognize that the rule typically requires that you admit the entire record with the certification, but because of the volume of documents in, that we've offered, we admitted select portions by agreement. These are the actual entirety of those business records. So in some respects, 29 as to Lori for Style and 29 as to Lollytime are more complete than any of the other business records we've done because it's the entirety of those records. And you're, so the court has before it the certification, and the agreement was that the underlying records came in and, in fact, have been used with multiple other witnesses, but not in their entirety, without objection. Nate Duncan, Detective Hermosillo, referenced by Detective Pillar. So these records have been in, referenced by multiple individuals, and now the state is providing the entirety of both business record sets to the court.
All right, thank you for the explanation, Ms. Smith. So the court's considered the objection of the defense on 29C and D. The court's also considered previous ruling allowing for the admission of Exhibit 29. The court will overrule the objection as it relates to the hearsay objection finding that because these are the accounts of the defendant and the statements therein made by the defendant would not be subject to a hearsay exclusion, and those other statements in there, as noted by the state, would not be subject to hearsay also, as they are not being offered for the truth of the matter asserted. Also, that there's been a, essentially a waiver of further objection where the information contained in 29 C and D, where 29 was already admitted and multiple witnesses have already testified to information contained within 29. C and D is the entirety of that information from where that other testimony came from, that it would be appropriate to allow 29 C and D, which is the complete version of the records, to be admitted. So for that reason, exhibits 29 C and D will be admitted. And finally, also finding that this witness laid an adequate foundation upon identifying those thumb drives. So exhibits 29 C and D are admitted.
Thank you, Your Honor. And we appreciate that. And we would ask that the court require that the state or that the court provide us with copies of 29 C and D so that we can review those so that they are, do accurately reflect what they what is purported to be on those. We don't have time to go through 100,000 pages of documents right now, but we would ask the court to give us this weekend to do that.
Okay. If they're obviously electronic copies, I believe, can be provided to the defense if they haven't already been provided, and those need to be provided to the defense before the state rests.
So would it be acceptable if we just tell them where in the discovery it is located, because it takes a long time to copy these, and they already have it at least once, if not twice, in discovery. Happy to show them where to find it.
Okay. Your Honor, I'm sorry. May I speak?
Go ahead.
My concern is that they're going to introduce something that we may or may not have or may not be able to access. I would like the court, if it's possible, to make copies of that and give it to us, because I want to know exactly what's on that jump drive specifically that's admitted into this court for the jury to view.
All right. Well, the court doesn't create exhibits, so the exhibits are admitted, but I will allow the defense an opportunity with the state to monitor also to simply produce copies of the electronic file that's on each of those jump drives.
Okay.
And as I understand it, each jump drive contains a single file, but it's a huge file of electronic information.
It contains it in a single record, and that record will, of course, that's an iCloud has hundreds of technically different things, but they're all part of the one record.
Okay.
We can't pull out the chats versus the SMS versus the videos versus the MMS. We would have 100,000 thumb drives. So it's the entirety of Lolly Time. It's the entirety of Lori for Styles.
Okay. Well, C and D are admitted, and again, the defense will be entitled to a electronic reproduction of C and D to be provided to them, which I would think is just a matter of copying the file over to a new thumb drive that's the same size and giving them that. But the state can observe when that copy is made through the court's official exhibit.
Thank you.
Yes, sir. Thank you, Judge.
All right. Do you want to continue then, Ms. Smith?
Yes, Judge. And just so that there's clarification, Mr. Wood is going to aid me in working with 29 C and D, so he will be over here, if that's acceptable to the court, getting that up and going, so people don't wonder what he's doing.
Okay, if he's there with technical assistance, that'll be fine.
Thank you, Judge. And I'm sorry to take things a bit out of order, Agent, but I just wanted to get that done sooner rather than later. You had indicated, let's back up just a little bit, did you have any other responsibilities while you were the supervisory agent in Boise for coordinating with organizations, say, on behavioral analysis?
Yes, I did.
Okay. What is behavioral analysis?
The FBI has a highly specialized unit called the Behavioral Analysis Unit. They're sometimes referred to as the profilers. That's a unit that exists in Quantico, Virginia. It's comprised of actually five different sections: crimes against adults, crimes against children, terrorism, cyber and counterintelligence, as well as training and research. Each division or state in the United States has a BAU coordinator.
BAU, behavioral unit?
Behavioral analysis unit coordinator. That individual is responsible for getting additional training in behavioral analysis and acts as a conduit when a state or local entity needs consultation services. The BAU coordinator does a triage of those cases and helps facilitate which cases are appropriate for the behavioral analysis unit to look at. I was the BAU coordinator for the state of Idaho for approximately 13 years.
Okay. So are you a profiler yourself?
I am not a profiler, but I have attended a number of trainings and conferences and have read a lot of material as it relates to behavioral analysis in criminal investigations.
And in that role, your job was to help facilitate and move a particular case through the process of getting a behavioral analysis where it was appropriate?
Yes.
Okay. Now, turning back to your work and assistance into the investigation of missing or abducted children. You indicated that there is a need for rapid deployment, and you talked about going within 24 hours. Is there a specialized unit within the FBI that handles child abduction cases on a rapid basis?
Yes.
What is that unit?
So we have a team called the CARD team that stands for the Child Abduction Rapid Deployment Team. They've been in existence for over 20 years. They're essentially what we call a fly team. They are specially trained agents that are located all over the country, and when a child abduction takes place, they are deployable very quickly to bring their expertise to bear when a child goes missing.
Is there sort of a time limit on when you can bring in that rapid deployment team?
Well, their purpose in the immediate aftermath of a known abduction, their purpose is to respond. They don't take over the case. They're consultants. And so they come and they help the investigators ensure that all of the appropriate steps are being taken. Collectively, the Child Abduction Rapid Deployment Unit has responded to over 160 child abductions in the United States in the past 20-plus years. They are the world's foremost experts in those types of cases.
And so in this particular investigation into the disappearance of J.J. Vallo and or Tylee Ryan, were you able to work with local law enforcement on where those two children were?
Yes.
And how did that happen?
The Rexburg Police Department conducted a welfare check for J.J. Vallo, and subsequent to that welfare check, the very next day, they contacted the FBI in Pocatello, who then called me. And so my involvement in the case started on November 27th of 2019.
Okay. And did you partner with the Rexburg Police Department in looking for J.J. Vallo?
Absolutely.
And then ultimately looking for Tylee Ryan?
Yes.
Okay. And as a part of that partnership with the Rexburg Police Department, did the FBI request the assistance or ask the CARD team, the Rapid Deployment Team, to respond?
We consulted with both the Behavioral Analysis Unit and the CARD team. We did not ask for a CARD team deployment.
Why not?
We knew very quickly that Lori Vallo had lied to the Rexburg Police Department when they responded to do the welfare check, and within a short period of time were able to ascertain approximately how long J.J. and Tylee had been missing. And due to the span of time that had taken place, it didn't fall under the parameters of a CARD deployment for those things that are done in the very immediate aftermath of a child going missing. So we spoke with them, we obtained their advice, but we did not ask for a deployment.
Okay. And so you've indicated that you didn't ask for the deployment, but you also consulted with them and behavioral analysis?
Yes.
Why would you consult with behavioral analysis in this situation?
Because of their experience in a wide variety of cases. And so they have background and expertise that your average agent does not possess. And so when you have a complex, complicated case, we consult with them to try to get the best advice to help us as we proceed forward with the investigation.
So when you say get the best advice, does that mean helping you analyze evidence and assess and maybe reach conclusions?
No. The behavioral analysis unit would give advice. For instance, if we had a critical interview, we might talk to them about that subject and get some strategies that they may suggest for the most effective interview techniques. But in this instance, and they can provide an analysis of their own, but in this instance, most of the analysis in this case was done in-house by us here.
Okay. And when you say in-house by us here, when you say analysis, what does that mean?
Well, an analysis simply means looking at and reviewing various types of records and data. There's a vast spectrum of information that's valuable to us in these investigations, from business records, cell phone records, iCloud records, so on and so forth, video records. We review all of those things to look for evidence relevant to the case.
And so when you say evidence, that means common ideas, investigative leads, themes or theories that the investigators need to follow up on?
Yes and no.
How yes and how no?
So yes, in the sense that when we are trying to determine a motive for a crime, there may be a theme that is relevant that gives us an indication as to why an individual may have committed a crime. No, in the sense that we are fact finders, and so our job is to investigate thoroughly and carefully and completely in an effort to solve the crime and develop evidence of who committed that crime. And in that sense, we aren't driven by a theme or a concept. We're driven by evidence. We follow the evidence that we find.
You follow the evidence where it goes?
Yes.
And if it's centered around a particular subject, you follow that subject wherever it goes?
Correct.
Okay. Now, specifically in the investigation into the disappearance and sadly ultimately the murder of J.J. Vallow and Tyler Ryan and the murder of Tammy.
I'm going to object to argumentative.
Sustain.
Specifically in your review of the investigation into the disappearance of J.J. Vallow and Tylee Ryan and the death of Tammy Daybell, what were your particular roles?
I had two primary roles in this case. My first role was as the supervisor over this investigation. Our Pocatello office is quite small. We had three agents assigned when this when we were contacted by the Rexburg Police Department. Very quickly, two of those agents transferred for one. Well, one transferred, one retired. So we were down to one agent. I supervised the activity of those people. When resources were needed, such as our evidence response team, or forensic accountants or analysts, or when leads needed to be set to other divisions, all of those things fall under my purview. And so I had the responsibility for the FBI oversight of this investigation. That's
in partnership with your local partners?
Correct.
Okay. And so when you say your responsibilities, just to make sure I'm clear, the resources of the FBI and what resources the FBI would contribute to that partnership were directed by you?
Correct.
Okay. And you mentioned, and I think I accidentally cut you off, you mentioned crime analyst?
We had an analyst assigned to this case, yes.
Okay. And what does a crime analyst do?
They their job is to look at records and to try to determine if there is relevant evidence in existence, for instance, phone analysis and analysis of Google accounts or other things. There's so much information in all of those records, and generally speaking, only a small portion of that may be relevant to the alleged crimes that we're investigating.
And so you were talking about your role as sort of supervisory role. You said you had two roles. What was your second role on this case?
My primary role was as an investigator in this case. I live in Boise. I work in Boise, but I traveled multiple times per month to Rexburg due to the complexity of this case, due to the fact that two children were missing. I felt that it was important for me to play an active role, given my background and experience in these types of cases. And so I, more so than my supervisory role, I played an investigative role in this case. I was present during the crime scene search where we located.
I'm going to object. This is a narrative. There's no questions here.
Sustained.
And so you played an active role. Not only were you a supervisor, you played an active role as an investigator in this joint investigation.
Yes, for all intents and purposes, I was the FBI case agent for this investigation.
Okay. And so what specific work did you do as the an investigator on this case?
I conducted a number of interviews of witnesses. I was present at the search warrant execution on June 9th and 10th. My biggest investigative role was to undertake a complete analysis of the content of two iCloud accounts that were registered to Lori Vallo. The first is called Lori for Style at iCloud.com, and the second is called Lollytime at iCloud.com.
And why was it important that those accounts be examined?
Because of the value of the information that's contained in those cloud storage.
When you say the value, can you help us understand why such accounts would be valuable to investigators in this situation?
Sure. The iCloud is simply the storage or backup for your Apple iPhone usage. Our phones are not phones anymore. They're phones, they're email accounts, there are cameras, they contain photos and videos. We have text messaging, we have multimedia messaging. All of those things are stored in the iCloud. And so in this instance, we have a large volume of direct communications between Lori Vallo and others in this case. We have a number of photographs and videos and emails and contacts and notes that are all relevant to this case that were discovered during the review and analysis of the iCloud account.
Okay. And that information was shared across departments and across agencies by multiple investigators, correct?
That's correct. We had access to these iCloud accounts fairly early on in the investigation, and they played an important role in our ultimate conclusion of what took place in the case.
And so as you shared this information, did it lead the law enforcement partnership to execute a search warrant on the Daybell property on June 9th and 10th of 2019?
Yes, it did.
2020, I think I misspoke.
2020.
Okay. And you explained you were physically present?
Yes, I was there, again, in a dual role. I was the FBI supervisor on scene for that search, but I also participated as an investigator throughout the two full days that the search was executed.
And so can you tell us about your personal activity at the Daybell residence on June 9th and 10th of 2020?
Yes. Our evidence response team was present to oversee the search, but due to the size of the property, other agents and investigators that are not formally part of the evidence response team were asked to help and to participate. The first step that took place was essentially walking the property, looking for evidence that might exist within the property.
And did you personally walk the property looking for evidence?
I did.
Okay. What was the next step taken after officers and agents working together searched that property?
Well, during the walk of the property, you're looking for places on the property that might contain evidence. So during the walk of the property, myself and an agent who was at my side located JJ's grave.
Can you explain to us the process you used to locate JJ's grave?
Yes. When you're looking for a clandestine grave, there are certain telltale signs that you want to find. Primarily, you're looking for aberrations in the earth. If a grave has been dug, typically the vegetation around where the digging took place is slightly different than the vegetation that's been undisturbed around that grave. Similarly, you will see sometimes a mound of earth where the grave has been dug, and sometimes you'll see a depression in the earth. In this instance, I was able to observe a slight change in the vegetation where JJ was buried, and then upon closer inspection, I was able to see that there was essentially a seam around the grave where the sod had been cut and then replaced, and so you could feel with your hands that there was the outline of where the grave had been dug was present there.
So when you say feel with your hands, did you actually feel the ground yourself?
I did.
Okay. And that area was photographed, correct?
Yes.
Okay. Your Honor, the state requests that just so that the witness looks at these again, that the witness be handed State's already admitted Exhibit 170C, 170D, 170E, and 170H. Sir, would you take a look at those, please?
Okay.
Okay. These have previously been admitted, but do you recognize those?
I do.
And just so the record's clear, it may have been a little bit since the jury's seen those. What are they?
These are photographs that were taken of the spot that I identified near the tree on the corner of the Daybell property where JJ's remains were ultimately located.
Your Honor, I'd request permission to publish or republish the state's exhibits 170 and the various numbers and use them during this witness's testimony.
Any objection?
No, Your Honor.
All right, they can be published.
Sir, you indicated a discussion on a change of vegetation. I would like you to chat with us if you see that in State's Exhibit 170C. And let me zoom out.
Yes, so this is a faraway view. The subsequent photographs will be a little more telling, but essentially you can see right here this little spot. If you look at the greenery that surrounds this spot and you can see some yellowing, and it's just, unless you knew what you were looking for, you might not notice it, but this is JJ's grave.
You previously talked about signs of signs of a clandestine grave. Is that one sign of a clandestine grave?
It is.
Okay. Were there particular pieces of evidence that took you to that area of property?
Yes.
What were those pieces of evidence that took you and the other agent to that area of the property?
We searched the entire property, but we knew that on September 23rd, of 2019 that Alex Cox's cell phone had been located in that area for a period of time.
Okay. So going to that area, you saw that area and that sort of yellowing, and you said there's another picture that perhaps shows it better?
Yes.
Okay. Let me show you State's Exhibit 170D. Is that the better view of what you were talking about?
Yes. This is a close-up view. And so you can see the vegetation here is fairly long and lush, but you have this slight area here where the vegetation simply isn't growing as well, and you can see a defined outline. You can even see some edges here. And so that ultimately ended up being where JJ's remains were found.
Okay. And you indicated that you felt the ground in this area. Is that the area that you felt the ground in?
Yes, I felt the ground with my hands, but I also had, we carry a probe with you, which is essentially just a rod with a point on it to be able to, if you find an area that you suspect may be something you want to examine further, you use that probe to determine if hard, undisturbed ground exists, that probe doesn't really go in. If you've dug the earth up, the probe usually goes in considerably easier.
And were you carrying one of those probes?
I was.
Okay. And you put the probe in the ground in this area?
I attempted to.
Okay. Let me show you State's Exhibit 170E. Is that one of the areas where you attempted to put the probe in the ground?
Yes, that's just an even closer up shot that essentially shows the seam, or one of the, if we look at it as a rectangle, it's just one of the seams that existed where the sod had been cut up.
And when you say the seam, and I apologize, I may not have asked you, so forgive me. Turning back to State's Exhibit 170D, can you outline that seam again, that area, that rectangle you were talking about?
Certainly. So this would be the top right here. You can see that line there. You follow it down here. There's the bottom. And then here's the other side. So this is your rectangle.
Okay. And so when you located that, was that area approximately how big, or do you know?
It's quite small. The seams on either end are probably 18 to 24 inches, and then the length would be approximately 48 inches.
Okay. Child size?
Yes.
Okay. And so you said you attempted to put the probe in. What do you mean by that?
I mean the probe wouldn't penetrate the earth.
Okay. Well, if that's a sign of a clandestine grave, why did you continue to look there?
I'm sorry.
If I thought you said earlier that a sign of clandestine grave was that you stick the probe in and the ground is loose, but if it's hard, it may not be. What caused you to look further when the probe didn't go all the way in?
Well, there the probe is just one simple tool that we use, and ultimately we understood why the probe didn't go in. Once we lifted the sod away, we saw that some boards and rocks had been placed on top of JJ's body, and so my probe was hitting those rocks and boards.
Okay. And so that would be as what was reflected in State's Exhibit 170H?
Correct. So this is a photograph of that spot that we've been looking at. And this shows where we have, you can see where the roots and vegetation from the tree have been cut to prepare the grave. And then these rocks, and then this is one of two different boards that were present on top of JJ's body.
Okay. And so was the dirt on top of those rocks and boards seemingly loose or mounded in any way?
It was very, very shallow, so there wasn't a lot of dirt on top of these rocks. It was, I mean, as soon as we took the sod up, we could see that there were rocks placed there. This photograph shows the dirt having been removed from between the rocks as that grave was carefully and methodically exhumed. So this shows a couple of steps in where the sod's been taken away, and the rocks had been placed on top of boards. Once we removed the rocks and the boards, we began to see that something was buried there.
Okay. And ultimately, that's where J.J. Vallo was discovered?
Correct.
Now, we're done with pictures for a while, so thank you, ma'am. You were present when JJ was discovered, but other officers took over and helped exhume JJ's body, correct?
I was there through the entirety of that process. I helped exhume the grave and exhume the body, as well as helping to exhume Tylee's remains.
Okay. Multiple officers had to do those things, correct?
Yes, there was it's a large property, and there were several members of our evidence response team, along with detectives from the Rexburg Police Department, the Fremont County Sheriff's Office, and other FBI employees.
And because of the way those bodies were, multiple officers were involved in helping recover those remains?
Yes, that's correct.
Okay. So turning to your other sort of work as an investigator on this, you discussed your work in reviewing and the value of looking at the iCloud accounts of Lori Vallo.
Yes.
Okay. Now, how much experience do you have in analyzing such data in relation to the other facts in the investigations to help determine sort of the facts and circumstances or motives of a particular crime or suspect?
I have several years' worth of experience. The FBI specializes in long-term complex investigations, and those investigations involve, in most cases, the analysis of voluminous amounts of records. And so as an investigator, as a case agent, I've participated in the analysis of those records, of records in investigations for the entirety of my career.
Okay. And you personally have worked with Apple iCloud accounts and records?
I have.
Okay. And you've talked about sort of the value of them overall to law enforcement. But in iCloud accounts, what specific types of data are in those iCloud accounts?
Essentially, whatever is on your smartphone is in the iCloud. It's simply a mirror, more than a mirror. It's a storage device of the activity of your phone. So it contains your contacts. It contains your call logs. It contains your cookies. It contains what we call carved strings, which is data that's been deleted but hasn't yet been overridden. It contains SMS or text messages. It contains MMS or multimedia messages. It contains images, videos, and the list goes on and on. And so all of these things are present in the iCloud.
And forgive me, I heard you talk about lots of the multimedia, the pictures, the location data, the text. Does it also sometimes include things that somebody has tried to delete from their phone?
Yes.
In what way is that captured?
In a couple of ways. So you can delete something from your phone to increase the storage on your phone. But if your phone is backed up to the cloud, typically it's no longer present on your phone, but it still exists in the cloud. So you can have data on your phone that you've deleted. That data still exists. It still is present on your iCloud.
Okay. And what's a carved string?
So carved strings are data that has been deleted off of the iCloud but not yet overridden.
What does that mean?
I'm not a super technical guy, but it's bits and pieces of messages or communications. They don't make a whole lot of sense. The carved strings weren't really of any value to us in the investigation. I just mentioned that as a part of what exists on the iCloud.
Okay. And what tools do you use to look at an iCloud?
The tool we use is a software program called Cellbright. Cellbright does not alter the data, it simply organizes it. So Cellbright is a pretty user-friendly tool that will take the contents of the iCloud and put it in its various compartments, as I've mentioned, and then you can go in and view each of those separate places within the iCloud.
And when you're using Cellbright, does it allow you to look at the data but limit how much data you look at?
Yes. So with each of the different sections of the iCloud, you can apply a filter. And so that was something that I did fairly frequently in my analysis of the Lori for Style account, not the Lolly Time, but I did use filters in Lori for Style.
So when you say filters, is a filter say sort of date range?
Yes, you can use a filter that's particularly called capture time. So the Lori for Style iCloud account, the earliest records date back to December of 2000. That's far beyond the scope of this investigation. And so the capture time filter that I used for the purposes of this case was October of 2018, the month where Chad Daybell and Lori Vallow first met. And so I did some cursory review of earlier data just to make sure I wasn't missing anything, but I focused my efforts on the date at which the conspiracy that's charged could have began.
And what were those dates?
Primarily, I would plug in October 26th of 2018, and then I would examine from that date forward.
Okay. And why'd you pick that date?
October 26th, 2018 is the date that Lori Vallow and Chad Daybell met at a Preparing a People conference in St. George, Utah.
And so, and then you ended your filter when? On Lori 4 style.
There was a point in time in late November of 2019 when Lori Vallow stopped using her phones, and so the data in the iCloud stops when the phone usage stopped, and I can't recall the exact date. It's November 2019 for sure, towards the end of the month, but I can't recall the exact date.
And what was the date that the law enforcement approached Lori Vallow?
Lori Vallow was approached on November 26th of 2019.
Okay. And then, but some the data on Lori for Style stops sometime in at the end of November 2019.
Correct.
Your Honor, the state intends at this time to display State's Exhibit 29C and D. If we're happy to keep proceeding, but if we want to take a quick morning break so defense counsel can just double-check it now, understanding they want a copy, but I respect that they would like to see it, we can do that or we can proceed.
Okay, let's go ahead and take our mid-morning break at this time then. I'll allow defense to access that, so let's plan on starting up again no later than 10:30.
That wraps up segment number two in our continuous coverage of the trial of Lori Vallow Daybell. There is more to come. Press subscribe wherever you download podcasts so you don't miss any of it. I'm Tony Bruschi. Stay with us.
This is continuous coverage.
Continuous coverage.
Continuous coverage. In the trial of Lori Vallow Daybell
from the Hidden Killers Podcast.